You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Hello, everybody. I'm Dr. Petros Grivas. I'm a medical oncologist in Seattle. I'm a professor and serving as the clinical director of the GU Cancers Program at the University of Washington and Fred Hutch Cancer Center. I'm super thrilled and excited to talk today with an esteemed dear friend and colleague, Dr. Helen Moon. Dr. Moon, you want to introduce yourself?
Of course. Thank you for everyone for tuning in. My name is Helen Moon. I'm a medical oncologist practicing out of Southern California with Kaiser Permanente. And I currently am the director for GU Oncology Research at Kaiser Permanente.
Fantastic. And the title of the podcast today will be a podcast on real-world evidence with avelumab first-line maintenance and treatment sequencing in locally advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma. Helen, we're going to discuss a lot of things, right?
Right. I think what we would like to touch on in this podcast is data from real-world studies that's been coming online of avelumab first-line maintenance treatment in patients with advanced urothelial cancer, and the data that's relevant to the effectiveness, safety, treatment sequencing, and you know something that's dear to my heart, healthcare resource utilization, its impact on patient. One key caveat to be highlighted is that treatment options really vary in different countries, right? So some of the conversations about healthcare utilization is really a US-based system. So for our listeners, the points discussed may be affected by your local considerations. So Dr. Grivas, you are the world expert in this. Could you provide some background information on advanced urothelial carcinoma?
Thank you so much, Dr. Moon, and great to work with you and many others in the field. Urothelial carcinoma refers to cancers that arise in the cells that line up the urinary tract system. Approximately 90% of urothelial carcinoma tumors arise in the bladder, but we always remember that maybe other parts, for example, the upper urinary tract, like kidney, pelvis, and ureter, and of course, urethra, which is less common. The most common type is bladder cancer, as we discussed. Bladder cancer is very common in the United States only. Is the sixth most common cancer site with more than 83,000 new cases and around 17,000 deaths from bladder cancer estimated in 2024. Moreover, more than 4,500 cancers arise each year in the ureter and other urinary organs, resulting in more than 1,000 deaths. So a very common and important cancer. And of course, when we talk about metastatic urothelial carcinoma, this is usually a lethal phenotype of disease with a few exceptions. Key risk factors include older age, male sex, smoking, chronic inflammatory conditions of the bladder, resulting from exposure to occupational hazards, environmental chemicals, chronic infections, chronic inflammation because of catheterization, example, neurogenic bladder with chronic trauma, injury, and catheterization in the bladder, and genetic predisposition. Genetic factors may play a role and more than we thought. So we actually do a more and more germline genetic testing that can help patients and broader families, both in terms of the patient benefit, but also in terms of cascade testing and cancer prevention in the broader family for genetic predisposition. Bladder cancer can cause substantial morbidity and is among the most expensive cancer to treat based on the lifetime per patient costs, due in part to its high recurrence rate and ongoing need for invasive monitoring, surveillance, diagnostic testings, and of course, treatment. Advanced urothelial carcinoma refers to patients who have developed what we call stage 4 disease usually, sometimes stage 3 disease in some cases, which includes unresectable, locally advanced, or metastatic urothelial carcinoma, and as I mentioned before, has relatively poor prognosis. For example, historically, what we were quoting for years, the 5-year overall survival rate for metastatic urothelial carcinoma in the US has been less than 10%. We're trying to change this with the research going on, and we'll discuss today some of that research results. And survival rates are likely to be very similar For metastatic urothelial carcinoma arising from non-bladder sites, like the upper tract or urethra. And I would say we treat metastatic urothelial cancer usually the same, regardless of where it started, the organ of origin, bladder or upper tract or urethra. Factors associated with shorter survival in older studies of platinum-based chemotherapy include poor performance status, medical comorbidities and organ dysfunction, visceral metastasis, for example, if you have metastasis to the lung or the liver, and of course, bone metastasis is also a poor prognostic factor. Let me ask Dr. Moon, in your opinion, what are the recommended first-line therapy options for advanced urothelial carcinoma today?
Well, that was a really masterful review of the background. And I will comment on that piece you said about historically, we always consider this a highly lethal cancer with very poor survival, because as you well know, for decades, treatment has been essentially the same, right? Platinum-based therapy. However, in recent years, several treatments are approved for patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma, really enabling individualization of strategies that's tailored to each patient's need. So in NCCN and ESMO guidelines, and the version we're quoting from is updated in 2024, the preferred first-line option is combination therapy with an ADC, so an antibody drug conjugate, infortimab, and an immune checkpoint inhibitor, pembrolizumab. Alternatively, there's a recommendation for first-line therapy that's built off the efficacy of the decade-long experience with platinum-based chemotherapy. This includes adding avelumab, which is an immune checkpoint inhibitor, which is given as a switch maintenance treatment for cisplatin-eligible or ineligible patients who are progression-free after platinum-based chemotherapy. And this particular approach of switch maintenance avelumab has been approved in this particular indication since June 2020 in the United States. Alternatively, cisplatin-eligible patients may receive the IO inhibitor nivolumab in combination with cisplatin and gemcitabine, and that is also followed by nivolumab monotherapy in almost a maintenance-like approach, and this option was approved in the United States in March of 2024. Each of these treatment options were approved based on really high quality phase 3 trials that shows a significant overall survival benefit compared to conventional platinum-based chemotherapy alone. Particularly, EV-302 showed that infortimab plus pembrolizumab and Javelin Bladder 100 that shows significant benefit from avelumab first-line maintenance. The Nivo plus Gem and Cis was studied and published in CheckMate 901. For avelumab first-line maintenance, several real-world studies have also been reported from different countries that really form the body of literature that can confirm and extend these clinical trial findings in a more heterogeneous population. Previous studies in large U.S.-based population demonstrate that the real-world outcome in platinum-based chemotherapy alone, with median overall survival of 19 to 20 months, that's seen with platinum-based chemotherapy, and approximately 10 to 11 months with carbo-based chemotherapy in cisplatin-ineligible patients. So for the rest of this podcast, we'll really focus on discussion on findings of the real-world studies of avelumab maintenance. But first, I want to start with an overview of the Javelin Bladder 100. So for a reminder of our audience, that is the phase 3 study that got this particular approach FDA approved. And then we will follow with a detailed discussion of the real-world studies. So I think no one in the world is better than you to ask, because I believe you're the senior author on this trial, right? What is the key findings of the Javelin Bladder 100 trial?
Thank you, Dr. Moon. And this goes back in time, you know, almost 5 years ago in 2020, when the pandemic had started. We had the ASCO plenary session with Professor Pauls and other team members, and we presented for the first time the practice-changing data from the Javelin Bladder 100 trial. This was, as you mentioned, a randomized phase 3 trial that enrolled approximately 700 patients with unresectable locally advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma who were progression-free after 4, 5, or 6 cycles of first-line induction cisplatin gemcitabine or carboplatin gemcitabine. After a treatment-free interval between 4 and 10 weeks, between the end of chemotherapy and the randomization, patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive avelumab anti-PD-L1 plus best supportive care or best supportive care alone, which was what we were doing at the time. After completion of chemotherapy, we were doing active surveillance for those patients before the results of JAVELIN Bladder 100. After at least 2 years of follow-up in all patients, the median overall survival from randomization was approximately 2 years, was 23.8 months with avelumab plus best supportive care versus 15 months with best supportive care alone. And the median progression-free survival also favored the avelumab arm, 5.5 versus 2.1 months median PFS, respectively. In a post-hoc exploratory descriptive analysis, median overall survival measured from the start of first-line chemotherapy was 29.7 months with avelumab plus best supportive care and 20.5 months with best supportive care alone. Again, this was an exploratory post-hoc analysis. It, of course, has to be interpreted with caution because the trial enrolled in a selected patient population without progression after first-line chemotherapy, similar to real-world studies of avelumab first-line maintenance that we will discuss in a second, which means that time on chemotherapy prior to randomization can introduce immortal time bias, because patients have to be alive to get into the avelumab maintenance phase. So immortal time refers to time included in the observation period when the outcome of interest, for example, death, when you talk about overall survival, could not have occurred, which here relates again to overall survival after chemotherapy was received, but before maintenance treatment was started. Because as I mentioned, trial selected patients on enrollment who were progression-free after first-line chemotherapy. It is also important to note that very few patients received subsequent treatment with antibody drug conjugates such as enfortumab vedotin or other short targeted therapies like erdafitinib due to the time period where the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial was enrolled. Just to remind the audience, the trial was presented for the first time in June 2020, so it was kind of the earlier days before many of the new recently approved agents were available when the trial was conducted. In the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial, efficacy benefits were observed regardless, irrespective of characteristics of platinum-based chemotherapy, including which platinum agency or carbo was used, number of treatment cycles, achievement of complete or partial response versus stable disease, which is a stratification factor, by the way, or the time interval between the end of chemotherapy and the start of the switch maintenance therapy. Efficacy benefits were also observed irrespective of patient characteristics such as older age or high body mass index, BMI. Longer survival was observed in patients with non-visceral metastasis or lymph node-only disease, and so those subsets also appear to have benefit with avelumab switch maintenance. In safety analysis, the long-term safety profile of avelumab first-line maintenance was confirmed after at least 2 years of follow-up in all patients. Treatment-related adverse events of any grade had occurred in 78% of patients and were grade 3 or higher in 19% of patients. Safety findings were consistent across all patient subgroups analyzed, and there was no new safety signal observed. Analysis of patient-reported outcomes showed that health-related quality of life was relatively stable during avelumab treatment. In addition, a post-hoc analysis from the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial showed that a quality-adjusted time without cancer symptoms or toxicity, what we call Q-twist, which is a measure of quality survival that incorporates efficacy, toxicity, and the patient-reported outcomes, was 22% longer with avelumab plus best supportive care versus best supportive care alone. Overall, these trial findings provided the first data supporting the use of first-line platinum-based chemotherapy followed by avelumab first-line maintenance as a switch maintenance approach in patients without progression on first-line induction chemotherapy, patients with advanced urothelial carcinoma. So, Dr. Moon, based on this context of the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial, can you tell us why it's important, in addition to the prospective clinical trials, to also perform real-world studies in general, and what are the limitations since you have done a lot of work in that setting?
Yeah, you know, as we've discussed before, I'm really quite passionate about real-world studies. And to define that, what we mean is observational retrospective studies, not interventional studies, right? Because I find that it really helps complement findings from interventional or randomized clinical control trials and assess the impact of these new treatments in relevant patient populations. These kind of studies, real-world studies, can confirm the clinical effectiveness and provide an expanded safety assessment in heterogeneous populations, which can include patients who would not have been eligible for clinical trial enrollment. Frequently, we talk about how in the United States, a very small percentage, something like 1-3% of our oncological patients are actually ever enrolled on a clinical trial, which means that the clinical trial patients are a very unique and possibly healthier population. So drugs, as they're approved, does that benefit extend to the real world, right? And specifically those with poor performance status or with other medical comorbidities. Real world studies can also generate data on treatment patterns and sequencing. So once something gets approved, how is it used? Is it first line? Is it second line? How are clinicians in the United States thinking about these options? And it can also provide insights into whether treatment use is consistent with the guidelines that we provide, and provide data on any costs and healthcare resource utilization, such as hospitalizations and emergency room department, which not only impacts the bigger system, but also really impacts the patient experience. So a patient who's alive, but alive hospitalized and going to the emergency every single week would have a very different quality than someone who's at home and able to maintain their activities of daily living. Having said all of this very positive things about real world studies, there's obviously inherent limitations, right? So number one, real world studies by definition have no randomization, have no blinding. It limits the potential for whether or not what you're observing as an outcome, positive or negative, is due to the actual treatment you have in mind that you're looking at, or other confounding factors. Is it suburban, distance to the emergency room, you know, other health medical issues, financial toxicity, and so on. And specifically, real world populations really have greater potential for sampling and selection bias and confounding bias, which is when these outcomes are affected by factors other than the treatment that you're looking at, right? And data quality can also be sometimes lower because of missing or unknown patient data due to poor compliance with follow-up, or just in general, incomplete data collection, in addition to sometimes recall bias for retrospective studies. And we all know adverse events are often underreported in real-world studies compared to clinical trials, so potentially we miss those type of signals. Other limitations in some real-world studies may include sometimes a very small population size. Sometimes the follow-up duration is fairly limited, and there's a lack of patient-reported outcome. The analysis of data is not really collected for research purposes and kind of satisfy that level of clarity, which may result in misclassifications of treatment lines. So there's a lot of problems potentially with it. However, even noting all of that, real-world studies can expand, complement, and validate the findings of clinical trials, and treatment decisions should be based on the totality of all the data that we can gather. The more we know, the more we know, right? So the summary of the benefits and limitations of real-world studies are also provided in the informatics that is attached to this podcast, which may graphically show you what we are talking about. So Dr. Grivas, can you tell us what has been reported in the real-world studies of this avelumab first-line maintenance in a U.S.-based population?
Thanks, Dr. Moon. Thank you for doing such a comprehensive job, you know, outlining the characteristics and the importance and limitations of real-world studies. And on that note, several real-world studies have examined avelumab first-line maintenance following first-line platinum-based chemotherapy in the U.S. populations. Additional details for all the studies to be discussed are provided in the infographic that you mentioned, and we encourage the audience to see that infographic. It's very helpful. Patriot 2 was a retrospective multicenter chart review study that included 160 patients who received avelumab first-line maintenance at 37 geographically dispersed sites, including community oncology practice and academic centers. And I had the honor to lead that study along with many colleagues. And Dr. Moore, you were a big a part of this study, and thank you for your contributions. Really, really important work you did. 8% of patients had ECOG PS2 or higher, and first-line chemotherapy, including cisplatin, in about 60% of patients, and carboplatin in about 40% of patients. So slightly more than half patients had cisplatin as part of chemotherapy induction phase. Median overall survival was approximately 2 years, 24.4 months, and median PFS was 5.4 months, both measured from the start of avelumab treatment. So I would argue in line of what we saw with Javelin Bladder 100 trial. Median overall survival from the start of first-line chemotherapy, again, exploratory observational endpoint here, in this selected population who had response to stable disease with first-line chemotherapy before avelumab started, was 30.5 months. Again, in line with what we saw in the exploratory analysis of the Javelin Bladder 100 trial. Treatment-related adverse events of any grade were reported in 39% of patients, including immune-related adverse events in 22% of patients. Treatment-related adverse events led to a delay in avelumab treatment in 13.13% and discontinuation in 10% of patients, with 8% of patients hospitalized because of a treatment-related adverse event. At the end of the follow-up, 19.19% of patients were still receiving avelumab. Patients received a median of 9 doses of avelumab in that study. Overall findings show that the effectiveness of avelumab first-line maintenance in this PATRIO 2 study, retrospective study, was consistent with results from the Javelin Bladder 100 trial, and that treatment was well-tolerated. Real-world data have also been reported from retrospective studies from two U.S. electronic health record databases, Flatiron and Tempus. The Flatiron study, including 214 214 patients who received avelumab first-line maintenance, 89% of patients were treated in community centers, 8% were treated in academic centers, and 2% in both. 10% of patients had ECOG PS2 or higher, while first-line chemotherapy was cisplatin in about half, 54% of patients, and carboplatin in 46% of patients. Median overall survival and median progression-free survival from starting avelumab were 23.8 months and 5.1 months, respectively, in line of what we have discussed so far in other studies. At the end of the follow-up, 39% of patients were still receiving avelumab. Median time to discontinuation of avelumab treatment was 4.9 months. The Tempus study was a broader study of treatment patterns for advanced urothelial carcinoma, which included 180 patients who had received avelumab first-line maintenance. Median overall survival and median progression-free survival from the start of avelumab treatment were 20.6 months and 6.2 months, respectively. In patients without visceral metastasis and with no thoracic metastasis, median overall survival was 20.9 months. And in patients with liver or brain metastasis, median overall survival was 14.7 and 6.1 months, respectively. Overall findings from all these retrospective studies further confirm the effectiveness of avelumab first-line maintenance in patients without progression after induction chemotherapy in heterogeneous U.S. populations. Dr. Moon, with that data and context, could you share also what has been reported in other real-world studies with avelumab first-line maintenance in other countries?
Yeah, when you look at the real world data for avelumab first line maintenance, I think what you're remarking on, what we see, is that there's really a consistency of survival and of benefit. So real world data for this maintenance strategy have been reported in studies in several other countries. And again, these findings have been generally consistent with the US-based studies. So I'm going to take you through four large real-world studies. Probably the most famous is Avenance, which is a French-based study. It's an ongoing real-world and prospective study, meaning data is coming in a fairly contemporary way of avelumab first-line maintenance. And this, again, is done in France. So among the 595 patients in their cohort with available data, 9% had an ECOG performance score of 2 or higher. So certainly sicker than what you would expect or was allowed in the Javelin Bladder 100. Interestingly, most of these patients, 61%, have received first-line treatment with carboplatin plus gemcitabine, which, of course, will be a little bit different than the U.S.-based. This potentially is due to a regional difference in practice pattern. 28% had received cisplatin versus gemcitabine, and 4% had received dose-dense and VAC. Even though standing the the difference in the platinum partner. Median overall survival from the start of avelumab in the overall population was 21.3 months. And the progression-free survival in the fives, again, in this case, 5.7 months. In patients who receive cisplatin plus gemcitabine or carbo plus gemcitabine, median overall survival was 25.2 months and 18.9 months, respectively. Median overall survival was not reached in patients with locally advanced disease and was 20.7 months in patients with overtly metastatic disease. The median overall survival from the start of the first-line platinum-based chemotherapy in this population who had response or stable disease with the first-line chemotherapy before avelumab was 26.5 months. And in safety analysis, looking at this population, treatment-related adverse events of any grade were reported in slightly more than half the patient, the 55%, and categorized as serious and really a minor group, only about 6% of the patients. And that is the French experience. And the Italians have a study called READY, which have reported out. Now, READY is set up as a database with a large compassionate use program for avelumab first-line maintenance. This includes 414 accessible patients that are treated at 140 sites in Italy before reimbursement for avelumab was available. And all patients had ECOG status of 0 or 1, so relatively healthy population. And first-line chemotherapy was carbo plus gemcitabine in 53% of the patients and cisplatin plus gemcitabine in 44% of the patients. Again, consistent with other real-world studies, median overall survival was 26.2 months from the start of avelumab and 30.9 months from the start of first-line chemotherapy. Median progression-free survival was 7.6 months from the start of avelumab. And in this particular real-world data, subgroup analysis found that clinical benefit was generally similar, irrespective of age, the type of platinum-based chemotherapy, and the number of chemotherapy cycles given. And specifically, they're talking about 4 cycles versus 6 cycles of chemotherapy. Longer median overall survival was observed in patients with lymph node-only disease and in those whose best response to first chemotherapy was a complete response. In these subgroups, median overall survival was not reached, and 12 months overall survival rates from the start of avelumab were 79% and 88%, respectively. Now, there is another retrospective study that reports a data set from 108 patients. This data is obtained from 14 different centers in several European countries and the US. So really, I would consider this a Western world data set. Median overall survival from the start of avelumab, again, was not reached. And the one-year overall survival was 72.5%. Median progression-free survival from the start of avelumab was 9.6 months. And in subgroup analysis, again, you see longer overall survival was observed in patients whose response to first-line chemotherapy was a complete response or partial response versus stable disease, and in those whose ECOG performance status was 0 versus more ill, so 1 or higher. Three studies that primarily focus on the Western world, Europe, France, Italy. What's our Asian partners doing? So in Asian countries, real-world studies have also been reported. In probably the most well-known is a database out of Japan, which showed 453 patients that received avelumab first-line maintenance as a part of post-marketing surveillance in that population. 4% of these patients had a performance status of 2 or higher, and 6% has stage 3 disease, so not overtly metastatic. Prior platinum-based chemotherapy was cisplatin plus gemcitabine in 59% of these patients, carboplatin plus gemcitabine in 36% of the patients, and docetaxel in about 2%. The median duration of avelumab first-line maintenance was 5.1 months for this particular patient population, and the median overall survival from the start of avelumab was not reached, and the one-year overall survival was 78%. the safety profile of avelumab was really consistent with other studies, and the most common adverse drug reaction of any grade were actually infusion reactions in this population of 12%, and thyroid dysfunction in 7%. 8% of patients received corticosteroid treatment for adverse drug reactions, including high dose in 4%, which is defined as a total daily dose of 40 milligrams or more. While this is the best known of the Asian studies, consistent data have been reported in study with several other countries, Japan, Korea, on the European side, the UK, Germany, Portugal, and Australia also have other real-world study-based databases for us to reference to. Overall findings from these real-world studies suggest that the outcome with avelumab first-line maintenance have been generally similar around the world and are broadly consistent with results from JAVELIN Bladder 100. And this is despite variations that's inevitable among patient cohorts in different countries, their genetic makeup, their tolerance to medication, and the treatment and the selection of platinum partners in those countries. So Dr. Grievous, having reviewed both the U.S. and the rest of the world real-world database, can you walk us through what real-world studies can tell us about the treatment sequencing that includes avelumab first-line maintenance?
Absolutely. Thanks, Dr. Moon, for a very nice and comprehensive review. With the availability of several effective treatment options, treatment sequencing is a very important question in advanced urothelial carcinoma. Of note, only a subset of patients who receive first-line treatment go on to receive second-line treatment, which may be related to clinical deterioration and the need for hospice care, patient preferences, distance from the cancer center, and other factors. Additionally, access to second-line therapies, including regulatory approval and drug availability, varies between geographic locations. In a meta-analysis of various studies, the median percentage of patients who received second-line therapy was 43%. In patients who have received first-line platinum-based chemotherapy followed by avelumab first-line switch maintenance, preferred subsequent treatment guidelines are EV and fortmavedotin monotherapy or erdafitinib in selected patients who have susceptible FGFR3 alterations like mutation or fusion of FGFR3. As noted earlier, very few patients who were enrolled in the JAVELIN Bladder 100 trial received those treatments because they were not approved when the trial was conducted. However, outcomes with second-line and fortmavedotin after avelumab first-line maintenance have been investigated in real-world studies. In the Flatiron and Tempus US database studies discussed earlier, and fortmavedotin was the most common second-line treatment with avelumab maintenance. It was received by 55 and 64% of patients who received second-line therapy respectively. Additionally, data from patients receiving second-line and fortmavedotin after avelumab first-line maintenance have been reported from cohorts of 49 patients in the US-based UNITE retrospective study and 182 patients in the international ARON2 study. Across these four studies, median overall survival from the start of second-line and fortmavedotin treatment ranged from 11.2 to 13.5 months, and median progression-free survival ranged from 4.9 to 7.5 months. These data are consistent with results from the EV-301 phase 3 trial that supported the approval, regulatory approval of EV and fortmavedotin monotherapy in patients with prior platinum-based chemotherapy and immune checkpoint inhibitor. In the UNITE study, overall survival and progression-free survival with second-line and fortmavedotin were similar, irrespective of the first-line chemotherapy regimen used, best response to first-line chemotherapy, and duration of avelumab first-line maintenance. In the ARON2 study, echo performance status less than 2 was the only factor significantly associated with overall survival, while echo performance status and duration of avelumab therapy more than 4 months were significantly associated with progression-free survival. A more detailed analysis of treatment sequencing involving avelumab first-line maintenance was reported from the Avenant study in France that you mentioned before, Dr. Moon. At last follow-up, 21% of patients were still receiving avelumab, 55% had received second-line treatment, and 24% had discontinued avelumab without receiving second-line treatment. Second-line treatment was chemotherapy in 74% of patients, including platinum-based chemotherapy in 25% and other chemotherapy regimens in 49%. In addition, 19% of patients received second-line antibody-drug conjugate treatment, which was enfortumab-vedotin in 17% of patients, and sacituzumab-govitecan in 2% of patients. Baseline characteristics were generally similar between patients who received different second-line treatments. In an exploratory subgroup analysis in patients who received different second-line treatments, longer median overall survival from the start of avelumab was observed in patients who received second-line enfortumab-vedotin treatment than in patients who received second-line platinum-based or non-platinum chemotherapy, 36 months versus 13.6 months and 16.6 months, respectively. Median overall survival measured from the start of first-line chemotherapy was 41.5 months in the subgroup who received second-line enfortumab-vedotin treatment, 24.5 months in those who received second-line platinum-based chemotherapy, and 17.9 months in those who received second-line non-platinum chemotherapy, acknowledging the many inherent limitations in this type of analysis. In addition, a small retrospective study in Japan, including 31 patients who received first-line platinum-based chemotherapy, followed by avelumab first-line maintenance and second-line enfortumab-vedotin, median overall survival measured from the start of first-line chemotherapy was 40.3 months. Data on outcomes with other treatment options after avelumab maintenance, such as erdafitinib, sacituzumab-govitecan, or trastuzumab-deruxtecan, which are now options used in metastatic urothelial carcinoma after prior therapy, are currently limited. As discussed earlier, data in populations treated with avelumab switch maintenance cannot be compared with overall survival in other phase 3 trials in the frontline treatment setting because data were obtained from selected patient populations without progression after first-line chemotherapy. Dr. Moon, for our final topic, could you share what has been reported about healthcare resource utilization with avelumab first-line maintenance therapy?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Grievous. As you know, this kind of data is very, very difficult to tease out from available data set. And from what I know, there's two real-world studies that have provided information about healthcare resource utilization with avelumab maintenance strategy. In the U.S. PATRIOT 2 chart review study that you discussed earlier that we were both participating in, 160 patients, some from the community, who received avelumab first-line maintenance were analyzed and part of the study group. And what we see is that during the platinum chemotherapy part of the study, 16% of these patients were hospitalized for a mean of 3 days per person year, and 7% had an emergency room visit. During the avelumab treatment, or within 90 days after treatment, that's how we defined the maintenance treatment duration, 28% of the patients were hospitalized for a mean of 12 days per patient years, and 8% had an emergency room visit. Avelumab-related adverse event led to hospitalization in only 8% of these patients, and the other admissions were primarily due to cancer progression, surgical procedures, or medical comorbidities. So these data really show that healthcare utilization was higher during the avelumab maintenance treatment period versus the chemotherapy period. But that's primarily due to cancer progression because, of course, patients are on maintenance treatment for longer. So there's higher chance of the progression to occur during the avelumab maintenance in all the healthcare utilization, the emergency room visits that's associated with recurrence and progression. In general, avelumab treatment is much better tolerated than platinum-based chemotherapy. The second trial or database I'm aware of is that we looked at, this is a US-based cohort again, 900 patients, and this is really looking at healthcare resource utilization of different first-line options or were assessed. In order to be a part of this database, you would have had to receive both first-line and second-line treat for the treatment of this cancer. And if you look at the subgroup who received first-line platinum-based chemotherapy with avelumab first-line maintenance, 69% had an in-hospital stay and 61% had an emergency room visit. If you take it down further and looked at the subgroup that had chemotherapy alone without the first line maintenance, 79% had an inpatient stay and 56% had an emergency room visit. In patients who received first line IO treatment alone, so that's an immune checkpoint inhibitor treatment, 76% had inpatient stay and 46% had an emergency room visit. The mean number of inpatient stays per patient per month was 0.13 with the platinum chemo with avelumab maintenance, more at 0.2 with platinum-based chemotherapy without avelumab maintenance, and 0.18 in first-line immune checkpoint inhibitor alone treatment. The mean number of emergency room visit was not notably different with platinum-based chemotherapy followed by avelumab first-line maintenance versus platinum-based therapy alone versus first-line IO therapy alone, and these numbers are 0.11 versus 0.09 versus 0.06, and that is visits per patient per month, respectively. And so when you look at all of this data, it really paints a picture that avelumab maintenance is quite well tolerated. And in terms of healthcare utilization, resources, a reasonable approach. Having said that, we really need to comment on the fact that the limitation of these analyses include that this is primarily a U.S.-based pattern. And even in the United States, which is a geographically very diverse and large country, there are variations in clinical practice and costs that exist within one country. The absence of data for healthcare resource utilization beyond the hospital stays and emergency room, which is really the only so far database that we have available, really forms a significant limitation. So really call on the field to further provide data. So looking for studies that look at healthcare resource utilizations with other first-line treatment options for advanced urothelial carcinoma are needed, and I really hope data is forthcoming. But overall, the data that we discussed showed that metastatic urothelial cancer is associated with substantial healthcare resource utilization, really irrespectively of the treatment type. And just like you had alluded to at the beginning of podcast, you know, bladder cancer is one of the most costly cancer to treat, and this most likely reflects the predominantly elder patient population, their associated medical comorbidities, their performance status, and the very aggressive nature of this disease. So to conclude, take us to the finish line, Dr. Grievas, can you summarize what are the main take-home points from this discussion?
Thanks, Dr. Moon. Really important information, and thank you for covering this so well. It's so, I would say, important to acknowledge the challenge to get healthcare utilization data, and thank you for guiding us through that. Real-world studies can provide valuable insights, and I think I want to summarize here, the take-home points from our discussion. Dr. Moon. So real-world studies can provide valuable insights about clinical effectiveness, safety, treatment sequencing, and healthcare resource utilization in day-to-day clinical practice outside of clinical trials, as you said. Because real-world studies involve heterogeneous patient populations, data obtained can extend the evidence base and complement findings from practice change in clinical trials. This complementary nature is important. Across several real-world studies involving more than 3,000 patients treated worldwide, globally, outcomes with avelumab first-line switch maintenance therapy were highly consistent with the results from Javelin Bladder 100 phase 3 trial, supporting the inclusion of first-line platinum-based chemotherapy, followed by first-line maintenance as one of the recommended alternative therapy approaches in recently updated treatment guidelines for advanced urothelial carcinoma. EV and fortmovedotin plus pembrolizumab is the preferred first-line option in treatment guidelines, and nivolumab plus gemcitabine and cisplatin is an additional option for cisplatin-eligible patients. Real-world studies have also provided new insights for treatment selection in patients after progression on first-line maintenance therapy, demonstrating the effectiveness of second-line and fortmovedotin monotherapy in those cases and scenarios. Lastly, urothelial carcinoma care continues to be costly with high utilization of healthcare resources, as Dr. Moon, you pointed out, in terms of medical treatments, emergency room visits, hospitalization costs, among other costs. Thank you so much, Dr. Moon, for a great discussion today.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.